When his ex-wife disappeared in the middle of their bitter divorce, the police turned their eyes to him and his new girlfriend. She was in the vehicle when he tossed out bag after bag of his ex's bloody clothes along a local road. Is there a world where she didn't know what he was doing? This is the story of Michelle Traconis, the other woman who may be on trial for the sins of her boyfriend. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. In May 2019, 50-year-old Jennifer Farber Doulos and 51-year-old Fotis Doulos were in the midst of one of those divorces that can only be described as contentious. Since she filed in June 2017, their case so far had over 400 motions, and each of them was more outrageous than the next. Jennifer told a judge she was worried her husband might take their five children, ages 8 to 13, away from her to his homeland of Greece. Fotis said Jennifer had told him, "I can have the mafia break your dad's legs with a baseball bat." They were both angling for full custody by saying the other was dangerous. Jennifer was terrified that Fotis had bought a handgun, supposedly to protect his family. Fotis alleged that Jennifer was an unfit mother because she was taking meds for her mental illness. Nothing worse than treating your mental health issues, am I right? Fotis was also in a legal battle with Jennifer's father over money. Mr. Farber was Chase Bank's youngest senior VP back in the day, served as a fellow at the Brookings Institute to consult on public policy, and eventually started his own brokerage firm. He and his son-in-law, Fotis, had an agreement where he would lend money to Fotis to build quote-unquote super luxury homes. Fotis had his own company, Four Group. But eventually, Fotis stopped paying back the debt to Jennifer's dad. He had died in 2017, but now his estate was suing Fotis for $2.5 million. Jennifer had claimed in court filings that Fotis was a cheater who said he couldn't pay child support while somehow finding the cash for vacations to Europe with his girlfriend. So yeah, things were tense between Jennifer and Fotis, and the police were well aware that he had financial motive to see her gone. Her death would mean he would have access to their children's trust funds. And then Jennifer disappeared. She dropped the children off at New Canaan Country School on Friday, May 24th, 2019, in New Canaan, Connecticut. It's a town of about 21,000 people an hour away from New York City by train. One of those bougie places where people live when they want to access the salaries or the excitement of NYC, but also want a big house and a big yard and neighbors who all look like them. The area is known as Connecticut's Gold Coast. Jennifer was seen in her black Chevy Suburban at school that morning, but then she didn't show up to the two appointments she was scheduled for that day. Her friends and family reported her missing around 7 p.m., and then her SUV was located near Waveney Park. There was nothing suspicious in the vehicle, but maybe the 300-acre park concealed a secret. But 5 days later, still nothing had been revealed by drone, helicopter, search dog, nor pond dredging.
This morning, local and state police desperately searching for missing mother of five, Jennifer Doulos. Drones, canines, and a helicopter scouring a 300-acre wooded park in New Canaan, Connecticut, where her black Chevy Suburban was found 6 days ago, alarming residents in this affluent suburb.
I saw them with search dogs also.
Police say the 50-year-old was last seen Friday morning, dropping her kids off at school. Friends later reporting her missing after she was a no-show for several appointments and hadn't been heard from in about 10 hours.
Friends and neighbors called Jennifer a devoted mother, so reliable, gentle, and kind that she would never leave her five kids, which included two sets of twins, uncared for. They said that above all, she prioritized the health and happiness of her children. She had a blog called Five Make Seven about life with three boys and two girls, putting her writing degrees to use. Jennifer had graduated with her bachelor's from Brown and her master's from New York University. She had been a playwright and journalist in New York City, and now she was finishing a novel. Fotis said she made $390,000 a year, more than he did, and their home was worth something in the neighborhood of $4 million. But with Jennifer missing, the children were now living with their grandmother in New York City under armed guard. Fotis's access to them had been limited after he ignored a judge's order not to allow his Venezuelan girlfriend to stay at the house while the kids were there. Fotis's attorney asked that his custody case go forward even while Jennifer was missing so he could get them back. The court said no. Things hadn't always been so strained between Fotis and Jennifer Doulos. He had been married once before to another Brown graduate in Greece in June 2000. After 4 years, they split in a no-fault divorce, neither blaming the other for anything. The Hartford Courant reports that their divorce was finalized on July 12, 2004, and then Jennifer married Fotis a month and a half later on August 28th. They had also met at Brown in the 1980s, and a friend said that Jennifer was happy to marry someone she knew from way back, someone she could trust, even if he wasn't her intellectual equivalent. That quote makes me laugh. They had a lavish wedding at the Metropolitan Club in New York City. Fotis's affair with his Venezuelan girlfriend, Michelle Draconis, started 2 years before Jennifer filed for divorce. Apparently, the filing made her a quote-unquote nervous wreck, even though Fotis was the one having the affair. Jennifer told a friend she was scared for her life about enraging him. He had a history of reportedly berating her and the children, of allegedly punching a parking garage attendant, of being controlling to the point that outsiders noticed. An architect who met the couple in 2014 decided not to work with Fotis's company after seeing the way he summoned and dismissed Jennifer like a dog or a servant. Like so many other women before her, Jennifer hoped that having their daughter would change things, but it didn't. Neither did couples counseling. When Jennifer found out about the affair with former ESPN producer Michelle, she also learned about the many affairs before that. Fotis was apparently a serial cheater. A week after her disappearance, it was reported that blood was found in Jennifer's home in New Canaan, enough that she wouldn't have survived without immediate intervention. There were stains and smears on the floor and in her car, multiple areas of blood splatter. In body cam footage, the responding officer says he can see blood down the side of the vehicle in the garage and on its tire. It seemed to him like someone had tried and failed to clean the scene. Now it made sense why Jennifer's nanny had come to the house the morning she disappeared and noticed that 10 rolls of paper towels were missing. The nanny had just restocked the pantry the night before with a brand new 12-pack, and now there were only 2 rolls left. Jennifer's disappearance was now being considered a homicide with a serious physical assault aspect, despite the family's hopes that Jennifer would still be found. The same day, Fotis and his Venezuelan girlfriend, 44-year-old Michelle Traconis, were finally questioned at his house. After 30 minutes, they then drove away from the house, escorted by police cars. No arrests were made, but the two gave hair samples at the local police station. The next day, authorities returned to their home with a warrant for DNA samples. On June 1st, Fotis and Michelle were arrested and charged with tampering with evidence and hindering prosecution. On June 3rd, they appeared in court for the first time. Neither of them spoke, but Fotis's lawyer argued that he should be allowed a low bond due to his Ivy League education. Both were ordered to be held on $500,000 bond. On her way in, Michelle blew kisses to her parents and family who had come up from Florida, and it might have been with their help that she posted bail that afternoon. The next day, a judge revoked Fotis's contact with his children entirely and indefinitely as his mother-in-law filed for sole custody.
Do you think you've been treated fairly by the criminal justice system?
I do.
You do?
Yes. I think with the information they had, they did the best they could. And I understand they have tremendous pressure on them. And it's also statistically, when something like this happens, 90 or 95% is the spouse. So I can understand why people feel like this.
And your answer to that is?
What's the
when
question?
People say, yes, 90% of the time it is the spouse.
But what's it's your... 90%, it's not 100%.
So when people...
I'm in the 5 or 10% category.
At this point, the search for Jennifer's body had expanded to property her parents owned and vacant housing lots that Fotis's company was developing. The lots were so overgrown that police were using machetes to knock down the 5-foot-tall weeds. Authorities were also going through the dumpsters of a bakery that had caught Fotis on camera near their trash on the day of Jennifer's disappearance. And it turned out that the bakery wasn't the only place he had been seen that day. Fotis and his girlfriend, Michelle, were accused of stopping at different trash cans along a 4-mile stretch of Albany Avenue in Hartford. A witness saw someone matching Fotis's description, stopping in a truck like the one Fotis owned, to put multiple garbage bags in various trash receptacles. The truck's passenger thankfully showed herself in surveillance video by leaning out the window to smoke a cigarette. It was Michelle. In cell phone pings, Fotis's phone record showed more than 30 stops along the route. Investigators later found 2 of Fotis's license plates shoved down a storm drain and various household goods in roadside trash cans. The items, including the Vineyard Vines t-shirt Jennifer was wearing the day she disappeared, some mops, and a dish sponge, tested positive for Jennifer's blood. There were also 3-foot-long zip ties, a bra, a clear poncho, work gloves, a towel, and black tape, all stained with Jennifer's blood. There would have likely been even more found if some of the trash cans hadn't been emptied before authorities could get to them. Fotis was also seen removing a large, rigid object from the back of his truck that was now thought to be the WeatherTech rear cargo liner that was mysteriously missing from Jennifer's vehicle. On June 6, the CT Post reported that a neighbor heard a loud banging noise at a property Fotis was developing on the morning after Jennifer disappeared. Of course, one might hear banging at a construction site, but police were leaving no stone unturned at this point. More than 225 tips had come in, and 70 people had offered up their personal and business security footage in an effort to help. Days later, on June 9th, it was reported that detectives were trying to figure out why Fotis had been covered in poison ivy when they went to collect his DNA with that search warrant. Suspicious. On June 11th, Fotis was back in court as the prosecutor tried to get his bail amount increased, saying $500,000 was no longer enough with some new information that had come to light. It was revealed that tests on Jennifer's kitchen sink came back positive for Fotis's DNA. His DNA was found mixed with hers in blood found on the faucet. His lawyer said it was merely trace DNA, left over from a dinner Fotis had in the backyard at Jennifer's house with the kids days before she went missing. The prosecutor said he was only in the backyard. Still, the judge kept Fotis's bond at $500,000. Fotis used his 401k savings that day to gain freedom. The next day, police began searching a Connecticut lake where Fotis would take the kids to practice water skiing. Apparently, some of the kids were nationally ranked, but Jennifer said in her divorce filings that they were actually tired of being pushed to such a level and had begged her to get their father to stop making them compete. Jennifer said they were all terrified to go against Fotis because he would do things like break a ski against a rock in a fit of rage when one of the kids had said he was too tired to practice. It certainly would have been a way to get back at Jennifer stashing her body there, but nothing was found. Fotis's lawyer suggested that Jennifer may have planned her own disappearance, like the novel Gone Girl. He said she had written a similar kind of book that had never been published and claimed that she had the imagination and motive to do the same sort of thing to hurt Fotis. At this time, the lawyer also claimed that Jennifer had been struggling with heroin her whole life, had a drug dealer who would get her heroin from Cambodia, lived for years under a false name, had severe psychiatric problems, and was about to lose her children because of it. I guess you can speak ill of the dead when no one knows for sure they're dead. A family friend said Jennifer's novel was nothing like Gone Girl, and was actually about searching for connection and a loving relationship where a person could be their true self. And speaking of loving relationships, you'll be sad to note that by June 25th, Fotis and his girlfriend Michelle had broken up, but Fotis was asking the court if it was okay for him to see her. His lawyer wrote in a motion that Fotis wanted to thank Michelle for some kind words she had said in support of him, although this strikes me as a pretty foreboding thing if you believe that Fotis had something to do with the disappearance of his wife. Like that scene in Goodfellas where Jimmy tells Karen to go pick out a Dior dress right around the corner. Not scary at all. Michelle said, I'm good. Please bar him from contacting me. And I know I'm getting too in the weeds here, but one of the weirdest news stories to come out around this time was that a man on crack found a knife and a pillow soaked in blood near some of the trash cans where Fotis dumped evidence, but he traded the knife to a dealer named Fudge for some more crack. They do have the man on video fishing the items from the trash can, so it really could be a true story. But as of now, the knife hasn't been recovered. In September 2019, Fotis was arrested again on a new charge of tampering with evidence. This time, girlfriend Michelle had told Connecticut police that he had to have his truck washed because the body of Jennifer at some point was in there. So much for her supposedly saying kind words about him. In the warrant for his arrest, it said that Jennifer's blood had been found on the truck. It also theorized that Fotis was waiting for Jennifer at 8:05 a.m. when she returned home from dropping the kids off at school, and that the person seen driving her vehicle away from the home at 10:25 a.m. was Fotis. Authorities believe Jennifer's body was probably inside her Chevy Suburban at that time and then was moved to the truck of one of Fotis's employees. See, Fotis borrowed a truck from his employee on the day of Jennifer's disappearance and was tracked driving it from New Canaan, where she lived, to Farmington, where he lived. Fotis later angrily insisted that the employee replace the seats in his own truck or completely sell the thing just in case cops might find a hair of Jennifer's inside. You know, a hair that might still be on him for when he hugged her on Mother's Day, 12 days before she disappeared. The thing is that the employee, in a complete stroke of genius, held on to the seats after he replaced them, just in case. They tested positive for Jennifer's blood. Michelle was herself arrested the following day under new charges, and it was revealed that she and Fotis had written alibi scripts together in the days following Jennifer's disappearance. It's not a terrible idea to get your alibi together when you're close to a case, of course, especially because your details could help solve it. The problem is that Fotis and Michelle wrote multiple versions and concocted events and witnesses that were simply lies. They were making up an alibi. Of course, the dumping of the trash bags was never mentioned in these scripts. Michelle maintained her innocence, though, saying that yes, she helped Fotis clean up a spill in the truck on the day Jennifer disappeared, but she thought it was coffee. She said she couldn't remember what color it was, but she noticed it didn't smell like coffee, but she didn't think anything of it. Once again, they both posted bail. But finally, in January 2020, Fotis was arrested and charged with capital murder, murder, and kidnapping. Michelle was arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit murder. And, oh, get this, Fotis's lawyer was also arrested for allegedly digging a grave the week before Jennifer's disappearance. The guy was one of the original founders of the Windsor Rod and Gun Club, but was no longer a member, so he asked a current member about getting access to the property. The member told him about a hidden key that would get him in. This was back in March or April of 2019. Then in May 2019, the month that Jennifer disappeared, two members of the club stumbled upon a hole, a tarp, and some lime on the grounds. They called it 100% a human grave.
Kent Mawinney's arrest warrant affidavit details that Mawinney had reached out to another club member in March or April 2019. He had said he wanted to get back into the club and had inquired how to get back onto the property. It's a gun club that, according to neighbor Nick Duckmanovic, is quiet during the week.
Usually on Saturdays, we'll wake up to hunters over in the field over there. So, I mean, there's just usually some guns going off. And, I mean, every once in a while, you'll see some game.
However, on May 18th, 2019, two members went hunting on the Windsor Rod and Gun Club property. They uncovered two barbecue grill grates, which had been placed over a hole dug into the ground. Small branches and leaves had been placed on the grill grates to hide the pit beneath. The members described the hole as 100% a human grave. Inside the hole, one member found a blue tarp and two unopened bags of lime. Lime that, according to the arrest warrant affidavit, could be used to help dispose of remains.
But of course, there wasn't anyone buried there, so they just kind of shrugged it off. It was only when Jennifer went missing a week later that a light bulb went off for one of the Hunt Club members who had found the grave. Fotis had called his alleged hole-digging lawyer on the day of Jennifer's disappearance. At the time, he and Michelle were likely dumping evidence into those trash cans. And the lawyer's phone records show him at the gravesite a few days later. But when a canine unit went to search it, they found nothing to raise any red flags there. But speaking of red flags, Fotis was let out on bond again thanks to a new rich girlfriend, Anna Curry. He said she was only a friend. Either way, thanks to her, he was a free man, but it seems he wasn't without his demons. Fotis was seen in late January stopping by a makeshift memorial people had created near his home in remembrance of Jennifer and removing items from it. He said they were placed there to taunt him. That's right, taunted by a candle. But I guess he really was being taunted by the public or haunted by his regrets because days later, Fotis attempted to end his own life in his home. Officers were alerted to check on him when he didn't show up for a court date. They found him in his SUV in his garage, trying to use a vacuum cleaner tube and carbon monoxide to bring about his death. His skin was gray and he wasn't breathing. He was given CPR and transported to New York City for a hyperbaric chamber treatment while in critical condition. Police found a note written by Fotis before the attempt that said he was innocent. It read, "If you are reading this, I am no more. I refuse to spend even an hour more in jail for something I had nothing to do with. Enough is enough. If it takes my head to end this, so be it. I want it to be known that Michelle Traconis had nothing to do with Jennifer's disappearance, and neither did Kent Mawinney." That's his lawyer who dug the 100% human grave. "I ask the state to let them free of any such accusations. I also ask the state to stop harassing my friends, Andrea Tutsiaridis and Anna Curry." Anna was the girlfriend who provided bail, and Andrea was a friend Fotis had asked to call him on the morning Jennifer disappeared to help create an alibi. "They are honorable people. Please let my children know that I love them. I would do anything to be with them, but unfortunately, we all have our limits. The state will not rest until I rot in jail. My attorney can explain what happened with the bags on Albany Avenue. Everything else is a story fabricated by law enforcement. I want to thank all my family and friends that stood by me this difficult time, above all Anna Curry. I am sorry for letting you down and not continuing the fight. Fotis." 2 days later, on January 30th, 2020, Fotis's children came to visit him and he was taken off life support. His family came over from Greece to see that his organs were donated and his quote-unquote name was cleared. They said he died surrounded by pictures of his children and called him a victim of mass hysteria. They also said he would be buried in his homeland so we awful Americans couldn't desecrate his grave. Days later, Michelle Traconis, his former girlfriend and alleged co-conspirator, was in court pleading not guilty to conspiracy to commit murder. She issued a statement that read in part, "I know nothing about Jennifer Doulos' whereabouts or what may have happened to her. Whether or not Fotis Doulos was capable of doing the things the police and prosecutors accused him of doing, I do not know. But based on what I have learned in the last year, I think it was a mistake to have trusted him." The charges against Fotis were formally dropped a month later on March 3rd. That's when his lawyer got to explain what Fotis meant in his note when he said his lawyer knew why he was seen on surveillance video dumping Jennifer's items into trash cans along the road. His claim was that the real killer left the bloody clothes on his front porch and he had to throw them away to avoid looking guilty. More than a year later, in July 2021, Fotis's lawyers settled a lawsuit filed by Jennifer's and Fotis's families against them. The lawyers not only had to pay back $137,000 of the $250,000 retainer Fotis had paid them, but they were also barred from talking about the case for 40 years, so no book deals nor lifetime movies for them. Throughout 2020 and 2021, the search for Jennifer continued. There was always some new search warrant being issued for one of Fotis's old properties, or cadaver dogs being led to the septic tank of the house where he lived. Authorities kept trying the park where Jennifer's car was found, convinced they must have missed something. A family representative said in 2022, "We feel the immeasurable loss of her person every day. We also delight in her presence and celebrate her spirit as they manifest in her five incredible children." Her kids were now teenagers and tweens who still didn't know what happened to their mother. In October 2023, even without her body ever being found, Jennifer was officially declared dead. On January 11, 2024, the trial began for now 49-year-old Michelle Traconis. She faces up to 20 years in prison if found guilty. At the time of recording this video, she's still pleading not guilty to conspiracy to commit murder, evidence tampering, and hindering prosecution. On the first day of the trial, jurors saw body cam video and crime scene footage, including the moment where officials found Jennifer's purse abandoned on the kitchen floor. On day two, a now-retired detective testified about red stains inside a roll of paper towels and in the garage of Jennifer's home. A police sergeant discussed the evidence in Jennifer's SUV and the fact that her trunk liner was missing while the regular floor mats were in place. It's believed Fotis used that trunk liner to transport Jennifer's lifeless body. On day three, the family's nanny testified while wearing a necklace with the number 5 hanging from it, likely to honor Jennifer's 5 kids. She called Jennifer silly and nurturing toward the children, and called Fotis harsh toward Jennifer. She recalled a time when Fotis tried to hit Jennifer with his vehicle, and when he chased Jennifer through the house in a rage. On day four, the nanny's testimony continued as she talked about how Jennifer confirmed Fotis's affair with Michelle by going through his email. The nanny said Jennifer began moving some things out of the house in secret, afraid of what Fotis might do to her and the kids if he knew she was leaving. The nanny also testified that they locked all of the doors when Fotis came over for dinner in the backyard with the kids days before Jennifer disappeared, so his lawyer's previous argument that he had recently been inside her home for innocent reasons was false, and there's no good way to explain his DNA on her kitchen faucet. On day five, a Connecticut forensic analyst testified about how the blood found in Jennifer's home and SUV did belong to her, and Michelle's lawyer admitted that it seems something nefarious did happen to Jennifer that day. He's just not convinced that Michelle had anything to do with it. The state cited software that calculates likelihood ratios and said it shows an overwhelming likelihood that it was Fotis's blood on the kitchen faucet and other places inside Jennifer's home. On day six, the state forensic analyst was back on the stand, with Michelle's defense lawyer trying to say that her DNA was never found at Jennifer's house. He said, "All of those results were negative as to Michelle Traconis, isn't that right?" And she said, "Or insufficient, or inconclusive." And that's the extent of the trial at the time of filming. As you can see, they're mostly just establishing so far that something terrible happened to Jennifer and that Fotis was involved. I'll keep you updated as the trial wraps up. As for what's to come, there are some 200 people on a list of potential witnesses to call. One of those people is Fotis's lawyer, the one who allegedly dug the human-sized grave at the private hunting club he founded. Many expect that he might be called to testify against Michelle. I think in my mind, it's sort of a given that Michelle will be found guilty, but maybe that's just me wanting someone to pay for what happened. But I can't imagine there's any world where a jury thinks Fotis didn't do it. And if he did it, I can't imagine there's any world where Michelle didn't know. And if she truly didn't know, perhaps she might have insisted on knowing why he was dumping garbage bags along the road. It's like if there's something you don't want to ask your gun-toting boyfriend who's in a bitter divorce with his ex-wife, is it because you already know the answer? I especially don't buy that she didn't know what was going on when she helped him concoct their quote-unquote timeline of the day Jennifer disappeared that happened to have some made-up bits. You don't need to make things up when you're innocent. Also, if your boyfriend has never asked you to help him shave his body, and then he suddenly wants help with that around the time his ex-wife disappears, girl, get out. One of the major things working against Michelle is that she's been accused of lying to police about whether or not she saw Fotis on the morning Jennifer disappeared. While being interviewed by police three different times, she told different stories. Her lawyer says it's the police who have lied and that it was wrong to interview her in English when her native language is Spanish. But the court noted that when meeting with her lawyer, Michelle never indicated that she didn't understand English and didn't ask for an interpreter. One of the things working for Michelle is that evidence from her phone will be suppressed at this trial. The police confiscated her phone back in 2019 while conducting a search of Fotis's home, they say in an effort to keep her from deleting potential evidence. But the judge ruled that it was wrongfully seized because they had a warrant for her phone records, but not her phone itself. It's really hard for me to watch evidence be left out of a trial on a technicality, but I also get how important it is to do things to the letter of the law when potentially putting someone in prison. As for the Dulos family, they've said, "We do not seek closure, as nothing can bring Jennifer back. Our hope is that this trial provides for accountability and answers." And I do hope they get that. At the very least, Jennifer will never be forgotten in the state of Connecticut. In March 2021, a state senator introduced Jennifer's Law, a bill that expands Connecticut's definition of domestic violence. Survivors like the TV and film star Evan Rachel Wood testified about how they suffered under the coercive control of their partners and how domestic violence is more than just physical battery. Jennifer's Law makes actions that cause fear or harm, such as stalking, controlling someone's activities, or denying resources, fall under the umbrella of domestic violence. So Jennifer Farber Dulos' memory will live on in this way. Thank you to the New York Post, the Stanford Advocate, and the Hartford Courant, and all of my other sources for the amazing reporting. I'm curious if you think Michelle will be found guilty, and if she is, will it be due to the facts of the case, or because the jury will want to see someone punished for the crimes against Jennifer? Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.